I restated that recovery from the nice guy syndrome is not about becoming a different person or a better person. It's about becoming more us. It's about learning to love me, embrace me, welcome every part of me, and integrate. There's that integrated myth. Integrate every part of me. How I think, how I feel, how I experience the world, my humor, my intellect, my sexuality, my dark side, my passion, my aggression. Welcome all of those pieces of ourself and integrate them into a conscious whole. There is that consciousness there of being aware of every aspect of who I am, not having to hide any of that, dismiss any of it, paint over any of that, pretend it isn't there. And so for me, becoming that integrated male, that conscious male, that authentic male, that embodied male, you know, that open-hearted male, that cosmic male, that divine male, whatever it is, means embracing and loving and being me.
Right. Check 2, 1, 2. Hey guys, welcome to the show. Thanks for listening. Your host, Mitch Lagden here, and this is Slow Down Man, the podcast. Really excited about our guest today. I know I always say that, but this guy, I truthfully am very excited for this to go into your ears. And we've got Dr. Robert Glover on the show today. He wrote the book, No More Mr. Nice Guy, as well as Dating Essentials for Men. But No More Mr. Nice Guy, a very well-acclaimed book, came out all the way back in 2003. And as we talk about, rings more true today than ever. And we talk about it. We dig into nice guy syndrome. We talk about what that is in detail. But really, at the core, it's a belief that you're just not good enough as you are. And so you repress the bad parts of you. You feel like you need to hide those bad parts of you and seek approval, seek validation in your life. And it doesn't have to be in all parts of your life. You can be balanced and integrated in certain areas and a nice guy, quote unquote, in other areas. And that's why I ask you to go into this one with an open mind. If you're listening and you're thinking, I don't think I'm a quote unquote nice guy. You know, I have boundaries. I have, I look out for my own needs and I don't get walked all over. That very well might be true in that relationship, but I challenge you to look and see if there are other areas of your life where perhaps you are a quote unquote nice guy and put your needs to the side for the, approval and validation of others. And then as a result of this whole resentment towards others, I know that's something I realized when I first read this book. I went in with doubt and I came out going, holy crap. You know, there are certainly some areas where, I found this was the case in my life. And I say at the end of the interview that it literally changed my life or changed my perspective on it, at least. And that is true. And, so I invite you to come in with an open mind and see if potentially there are areas where it's affecting you as well. We get into how you know if you're a nice guy, if you're acting out behaviors of this syndrome. And most importantly, actionable steps, how we can move towards being an integrated, conscious man with boundaries, connection with other men, owning our masculinity, the every part of it, the aggressiveness, our shadow side, everything. And the goal of all of this, by the way, is not to be better or different or, you know, to level up, as I think we're constantly challenged to do through media. It's always like reaching. How can I look more like that? How can I lose weight? How can I get more money? It's not any of that. It's shedding the layers, as we talk about with Dr. Robert Glover on the show, shedding the layers and not being better, trying to be better or different, but just becoming more us and realizing we're good just as we are. All right, guys, without further ado, take a few deep breaths, sit back, relax, and enjoy this one with Dr. Robert Glover. Not so fast. Guys, before we kick into this episode, I just really quickly wanted to ask that if you would, go over to Apple Podcasts, leave a 5-star rating, ideally, and a written review. Literally, that makes all the difference. Takes a minute of your time. But like I say, all the difference in growing the podcast, getting the show in more young men and women's ears. So we can keep on keeping on. All right, thanks, guys, and enjoy the show. Okay, guys, excited about our guest today. We've got the author of No More Mr. Nice Guy, A Proven Plan for Getting What You Want in Love, Sex, and Life, as well as Dating Essentials for Men, a more recent book. He'll talk about both. He's an internationally recognized authority on nice guy syndrome. This guy's helped change the lives of countless men and women around the world. Without further ado, welcome Dr. Robert Glover. Thanks for slowing down with us, man.
Mitch, thanks for reading a short introduction. Sometimes I go, oh man, I can't believe they found that on the internet and read all that. Thank you for the short one.
Yeah, no problem. It could have been as long as like Tiger Woods is, I know it's the US Open this weekend, so it could have been as long as Tiger Woods' introduction on the tee box where they just go on and on, the winner of this tournament. But I kept it short and sweet.
Thank you.
Okay, Robert, let's set the stage. What is nice guy syndrome? And for anyone listening, how do they know if they are a nice guy or are inflicted by this nice guy syndrome?
All right, just kind of the quick elevator spiel. Is it a nice guy? And let's talk to men and women both. I think your audience is primarily men, but there might be women listening in. And your guys listening might say, hey, my girlfriend, my wife's kind of like it. My ex is kind of like that. Because there's nice girls out there too. But I'll speak to men, and any women listening can just translate the gender, the pronouns. So a nice guy is somebody who inaccurately internalized at a very early age that it's not okay to be himself just as he is. And so began developing a life paradigm, again, at a very early age, in which they try to become what they think other people want them to be so that they can be liked and loved and get their needs met, and try to hide or repress anything about them that might get a negative or not so great reaction from anybody. So this is a person going out, as kind of the definition says, of seeking external validation, seeking approval from others, hiding a lot of things about themselves, and usually feeling pretty frustrated, not particularly happy, not nearly as productive as they could be, and even at times not being so nice because of resentments, frustration, passive aggressiveness, lack of honesty, and we dive into all of that stuff. But it's a person, again, just trying to get external validation because he doesn't believe he's just okay and that people would like him and love him and want to help him get his needs met just as he is.
Mm. Wow. Okay. Great. Short and sweet. The whole theme of this so far, short and sweet. I love it.
Let's just run with that.
Description of what a nice guy is. So say I'm listening to this. I'm a guy or a girl listening to this, and I'm thinking, oh boy, I think I might be – I might have this infliction of being the nice guy. So what are some of the telltale signs that might in fact be the case?
Okay. One, of course, that I mentioned is the approval seeking. If you notice yourself seeking other people's approval, feeling uncomfortable, anxious, if people seem to be upset at you in any way, if you have a tendency to hide certain things about yourself, your feelings, your wants, your behaviors, if you seem to have anxiety in most intimate friendship work context, and nice guy syndrome, I've often said it's fundamentally a shame-based disorder and an anxiety-based disorder. So if you tend to have these core beliefs about yourself that you're not good enough, you're afraid of being found out, you gotta hide certain things about yourself, that's the shame-based part. The anxiety-based part is you're afraid of doing anything wrong, you're afraid of anybody being upset, you're afraid of being found out. Anxiety tends to drive a lot of who you are. Nice guys are often less than honest, as I've already mentioned, because we're already trying to get everybody's approval, which means we're not being authentic or being our true self. We'll hide anything and lie about anything or make up stories about anything we think might upset anybody. A real core piece of nice guy syndrome is operating from what I call covert contracts, which as you recall from reading the book, that's a real core part of the nice guy syndrome. And so let me just dive briefly into that.
Yeah,
so briefly, the covert contracts are an indirect, covert, often unconscious way that nice guys go about trying to get their needs met. Mm-hmm. And the nice guys operate from three primary covert contracts, and they're all an if-then proposition, and they're all a give-to-get proposition, and they're all fundamentally manipulative, which is one more reason nice guys aren't always so nice. But covert contract number one for nice guys, if I'm a good guy, then I will be liked and loved and get my needs met. And the woman I want to have sex with will want to have sex with me. And that's a big covert contract for nice guys and women. Okay, I'm listening to you talk about your problems. You know, I helped you move. I paid your car payment for you. You know, I put up with your bullshit. Now you should like me and want to have sex with me, right? And this happens both with single guys and guys in a relationship.
Right.
So it's a covert contract. I do all this for you. You're gonna give back to me. You're going to love me back. And if it's a woman, you're going to want to have sex with me. Covert contract number two. If I meet your needs without you having to ask, then you will meet my needs without me having to ask. Now, again, this is also a pretty dysfunctional contract. Number one, because the other person doesn't know there's a contract. You're giving, hoping that they'll be appreciative and give back to you. And maybe that's what we want back, appreciation, validation. Oh, you're such a good guy. You're such a great guy. But the other part of it is, nobody's going to read our mind and just figure out what it is we want or need. And nice guys are also usually fundamentally really poor receivers. This is another real core characteristic of nice guy syndrome. Most nice guys unconsciously believe they're bad for having needs. People are going to be upset at them if they have needs. So they're going to be in trouble if they have needs. Maybe even they're going to go to hell if they have needs. I mean, I grew up in a fundamental Christian church. So there's a lot of, you know, just that woven into it. So that covert contract number two, I'll read your mind and meet your needs without you having to ask. I'll give to you what I need to give to you. You might not even need it, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. And then you'll give to me, but I'm going to be a terrible receiver and you won't even know what it is I need. And if you try to give to me, I won't let you anyway. That's real common. It's crazy, but it's a common nice guy pattern.
I just wanted to say it is crazy. And, you know, going back to what you said that, nice guys in reality, in their mind, they're like, oh, I'm such a nice guy. There's almost like this resentment towards how they're not being reciprocated by life with these wonderful relationships and whatnot. But in reality, through these covert contracts, as you mentioned, they're actually less than honest and not very nice guys in when you really look at what they're doing and how they're moving through life. Anyways, I just wanted to point that out. Yeah. Very interesting.
And that's a good point. And I'll also weave that back to the piece you asked of how do you recognize if you're a nice guy? If you find yourself feeling resentful in general in life, like feeling victimized, done to, if you feel it especially in your closest relationships, either friendships, love relationships, work relationships, because you feel like you give so much more than you get in return. That's covert contract. If you're feeling resentment in most of your closest relationships, that could be a clear sign you're a nice guy, nice girl, and you've been following these covert contracts, especially number two. I give, I give, I give at work. I give, I stay late. I help other people's projects. I give up my weekends. I do this. How come I get passed over for promotion? How come I didn't get the raise? How come my boss took the credit for it and I didn't get any? You know, so it can be work. It can be relationship of that giving to get. So yeah, if you feel resentful, pay attention. And then covert contract number three is that if I do everything right, then I will have a smooth, problem-free life. Now, this is based on a few fallacies. One is that we can do everything right. I mean, we're all perfectly imperfect, right? We're all bumbling our way through this thing. And, you know, what is the rule book for getting it right? There's a few of them that have been written, you know, the Torah, the Bible, the Talmud. And all of them say nobody gets it right. You know, right. Everybody falls short. Yep. But nice guys have this illusion, and we're also the scorekeepers. That's another way to know if you're a nice guy, nice girl. You got a scoreboard in your living room, you know, and you're keeping track of how good you are or how much you do or how nice you are and how the other side is not doing their fair share. So if I do it right, everything right, then I'll have a smooth, problem-free life. But the other fallacy here is life is not smooth and problem-free. Mm. Life is chaotic by nature. It began with a big bang, and it continues to manifest in constant change of, as Buddha would say, in manifesting and unmanifesting. Everything is in a constant state of change. So life is not calm, smooth, problem-free, especially relationships with the opposite sex, where that's right. Where nice guys really think, if I make her happy, if I give her everything she wants, if I just don't mess up, if, you know, blah, blah, then she'll be happy, right. You know, then she'll be in a good mood, and then she'll want to have sex with me on a regular basis. And then when they're not always happy or always in a good mood or don't always want to have sex, you know, it's, wait a minute, I've done everything right. Look, there's the scoreboard. Mm. I can look at it. You know, look at all the right things I did. How come my life isn't going as great as I think it should? And then again, those resentments come in.
Right. Oh, man. First of all, I love those covert contracts that you just brought up. And, you know, this podcast is all about helping men and women to bring consciousness awareness to unconscious patterns that they have in their life. I think there's a lot of people listening right now. I know when I read your book, I realized that I have some of these contracts in my life who have brought now awareness to those covert contracts. So awesome stuff. I'm curious though, where did you first realize all of this content around nice guy syndrome, covert? Like where I would imagine it was from personal experience. I know from your book that it is from personal experience, but if you can just talk a little bit about how you came to realize firsthand, you know, these existing in the world.
All right. Yeah. I am a recovering nice guy. This is firsthand knowledge.
Right.
I have a PhD in marriage and family therapy, which I earned that by the time I was 29 years old. So, you know, I've got this background in education, but no more Mr. Nice Guy. Very little of it came out of that. It came out of my own bumbling my way through life, trying with this paradigm of following those three covert contracts before I even knew about them. So here's the backstory of how I came to write a book and came to be talking to you 20 years after that book was published. I was in my second marriage and, you know, trying to make my wife happy and, you know, trying to be the good man, trying to be different from other men, trying to be different than her ex. I was raising her kids. She was moody. She was unhappy most of the time. She'd been pretty hypersexual before we got married on our honeymoon. She said, now that we're married, aren't you glad we don't have to pretend to like sex anymore? I'm thinking, I wasn't pretending, but I was a nice guy. So I thought, I know I can get her, you know, back to you know, wanting, but it didn't work. She kind of continued on not wanting to have sex for another 14 years or so with me. But you know, I can make this better. I can fix it. You know, I was just in that constant fix it, get it back to good mode, which a lot of nice guys, that's how we operate in life. I can make this better. I can fix it. So I was in the relationship and my frustrations and resentments were growing because she was unhappy most of the time. She was no longer sexually available. She was, had a lot of other behaviors going on. She was, you know, angry and hurtful and shaming and belittling. And I just kept trying to fix that and make it good. And my resentments were growing. And because I was a nice guy and already less than fully honest, I'd hide things from her, just normal things that didn't need to be hidden, but I was afraid of her reaction to them, trying to please her, building resentments, covert contracts. And she confronted me about 2-3 years into the marriage and said, I cannot put up with your passive aggressive behavior anymore. You got to go get some therapy. You got to get some help or I'm leaving. I can't live with this. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. You're the one that's angry all the time. You're the one that's depressed all the time. You're the one that no longer wants to have sex. You're the one that, you know, that, that, you know, all the energy in our family gets focused on you. How come I'm the one that, that needs therapy? So I thought, well, I didn't want to lose her. And so I luckily landed in some good situations. The first one was I joined a 12-step program for sexual addiction. I quickly learned that I wasn't a sex addict because I wasn't having enough sex to be a sex addict. But it was all men. So this was my first men's group. And I'm a big advocate of men's groups. And it was all guys. And they met like at, you know, 6 a.m. one morning a week. And for the first time in my life, I had a place to just start opening up about me. And I started, you know, releasing shame, just start telling the things about me that I'd kept hidden. Like I said, I grew up in a fundamental Christian church. I grew up with a angry, critical father. I grew up in the early years of feminism with all the women, kind of like nowadays, being angry at men. And they didn't call it toxic masculinity back then. They just said every man was a rapist. You know, now it's toxic masculinity. They put a little more finesse to it. And so I didn't want to be that bad man. So, you know, for the first time in my life, I just started revealing me, sharing me, and it felt liberating. I mean, it was like, man, I get to get up at 5 a.m. tomorrow and go to this group because I get to talk about everything I've never told anybody before. It felt really good. So the other thing is I got in with a really good therapist who taught me about boundaries, who started working with me about making my needs a priority. And, you know, and then I got into a men's group with another therapist, that's where I really started becoming aware of my covert contracts, revealed more shame, started embracing more of my masculinity, spending time with men. And so even though when I went to get help, as my second wife demanded, I went to go find out why being a nice guy didn't make her happy and didn't make her want to have sex with me. Luckily, I started finding out why being a nice guy wasn't serving me, serving her, the relationship, or really anybody else in this world. And in that process, I already had a private practice. As I said, you know, my background's marriage and family therapy. So as I was working on my nice guy issues, I started noticing men primarily coming with their girlfriends or wives, you know, unhappy in their relationships the same way I was. And they'd say things like, I'm a nice guy. I'm one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. I'm different than her ex. I'm raising her kids. I treat her well. I give her what she wants, a new car. I buy her a car, but it didn't have leather seats. She's still unhappy. You know, she never wants to have sex anymore. And I'm going, I can finish their sentences for them. So, and then there were the single guys, and the single guys saying, you know, all the women say they don't want a jerk. They want a nice guy. I treat women well. I'm not a jerk to them. And like I just end up in the friend zone. And they say, oh, you're going to make some woman so happy. So some lucky woman's going to be so fortunate to get you, but they don't want to date me. And they go, what's wrong with it? You know, they say they want a nice guy, but they don't want me. So as I thought, man, I'm not the only one thinking by me just being a nice guy that I'm going to get liked and loved and get my needs met and get the sex I want. So I started No More Mr. Nice Guy Men's Group. We met every other week and on Wednesdays. And on Wednesdays, I set aside as a writing day. And I just started writing what I was kind of discovering about myself, about men, where nice guy syndrome, where it came from, how it manifests, why it doesn't work, why we aren't so nice, how to do it more effectively, how to have boundaries, how to ask for what we want, how to embrace our masculinity, how to be honest. And I just kept writing and giving, you know, every week I'd give these guys a chapter. And they and their wives and girlfriends start saying, Robert, you need to write a book. You need to go on Oprah. This could be a bestseller. There's a lot of people out there that need this book. So I kept writing over a period of 6-7 years and writing and honing and learning about nice guys. And then finally finished that. And it took about 3 years to get it published. And a lot of editors at publishing companies said, Robert, we like your book. It's good. It's well written. But our marketing department says men won't buy a self-help book. I thought, you don't know these guys I work with. And, you know, that was 20 some years ago, and my royalty checks keep getting bigger every year. Wow. So men do buy self-help books, and they're hungry. Men are hungry for a model. I mean, we have no model of masculinity. It's all been thrown out. All we've heard growing up is don't be like your dad. Don't be like those jerks. Don't be like those bad men. Don't be this way. Don't hurt women. Don't. We have no clue what it means to be masculine. So men are looking, whether they're nice guys or just kind of, you know, lost, men are looking for tribe. They're looking for initiation. They're looking for a definition of how to be male, how to be masculine in a world that doesn't necessarily treat masculinity very favorably nowadays.
Right. Wow. Okay. Thank you for taking us through all of that. One thing from what you just said. So, you know, you said your book sales royalties are going up every single year. Obviously there's still a lot of nice guys, quote unquote, out there. This condition still exists and might be growing.
I think it's expanding exponentially.
And why do you think that? Like, what do you think is contributing to that?
Okay, well, think about this. Say you're born, you know, sometime in the last 10, 20 years. But let's say you're born today. You're a little boy. And odds are, as you grow up, your influences. Dad probably is not going to be around. For whatever reasons, either your parents are divorced, they never were together, he's working, now a lot of dads nowadays really are trying to focus and be there with their kids. And actually I hear a lot more nice guys now tell me, my dad was a nice guy and he raised me to be a nice guy.
Passed it down to him.
Yeah. But a lot of guys my age, you say, my dad wasn't around. So that has changed somewhat. But so most young men grow up without a strong masculine influence they can trust, pretty much highly influenced by women, their mother, who often goes to work nowadays, you know, when they're, you know, a few weeks old. So they often go to some kind of daycare or babysitter that's female. Then they get into preschool, which is female oriented. They get into elementary school, which majority of the teachers are women. So not only to get from third to fourth grade, not only do they have to learn their writing, reading, and arithmetic, they learn how to please a woman. And now the educational system is highly favored towards how girls learn best, not how boys learn best. So they're probably not going to fit in well into the educational system. They're not going to sit still. They might get diagnosed with ADD, ADHD. They might get medicated. They might just drop through the cracks. They won't have any masculine direction, initiation, and so they probably get caught up in the internet and video games and discover porn at 12 years old and get addicted to that and maybe start smoking pot at 14 or 15, you know, just escaping the world because they don't know how to fit in to the world. And in all of that, you know, they hit 14, 15 and, you know, they'd kind of like to get laid. They'd kind of like a girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they really have no clue how to talk to women. The women, all the girls they know are dominant and, you know, they're kind of passive and they don't want to be a bad guy that's dominant. And so they get frustrated and they don't know how to get a girlfriend. So they just keep looking at the porn and jerking off to that. And then they get to be, you know, 19, 25, 30 years old and they're fucking lost. They're just lost and they don't know where they fit in the world and they don't know how to get a woman. They don't know how to please a woman. They don't know where their passion is because nobody ever taught them it's okay to live with passion. So again, most of the younger men, they're spending all their time on the internet. They're on their phones. They're playing video games. They're smoking dope. They're looking at porn and they're just lost. And so I think that number is expanding. And I just reread the No More Mr. Nice Guy just a few weeks ago because we were kind of just doing an updated version of the ebook on Amazon. So I had to reread it to, you know, check for edits and all. And rereading it, I mean, it's been 20 years, 20 plus years since I finished writing it. And I've read it a couple, two, three times since. But, you know, after reading it like 10,000 times while I was writing it, yeah, for a while I didn't read it. But reading it again, two things struck me. One is that I was really happy with it. I thought, you know, I did a good job. You know, it's not ego. It just felt good, right? When you're too close to it, writing it, you don't know if it's good or not. But 20 years later reading it, I thought, yeah, I'd tweak a couple things if I did it, but I like it. I did a good job. But what really struck me more than that is that really in the state of affairs nowadays, 20 years later, it doesn't really just apply to what we might call a nice guy that I think probably most men nowadays would benefit from it just in terms of giving some masculine direction. And, you know, I do a lot of interviews. I talk to a lot of men's coaches, and I'm pleased that how many men's coaches tell me that my book is required reading. So wow. That means that's not just nice guys they're working with.
Right.
It's just men that need direction in today's world. So I guess to answer your question, basically, I think the bottom line is we men really lack direction nowadays.
Right.
And we don't know, how do we get our needs met? How do we get love? How do we get sex? How do we live with passion? How do we accomplish the things we want to accomplish in life? And, so I'm glad that No More Mr. Nice Guy still has a pretty good blueprint.
Still
for
rings true.
Those issues. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So I think we've dug deep into what a nice guy is. We've looked at, you know, how do you identify, if you're listening to this, if you are a nice guy or girl. But I know you also talk about in No More Mr. Nice Guy, the concept of an integrated man.
Mm-hmm.
And stepping into reclaiming personal power. Can you talk a little bit about that? And if I'm sitting at home and I'm like, oh my God, I'm a nice guy. And aside from buying your book, obviously, what steps immediately do I take to move towards that notion of an integrated man?
Okay, so there's a couple of questions there. What is that integrated man, and how what are the steps to get
correct.
There?
Correct, yeah.
So, When I was writing the book, I sent it off to a professional editor and got feedback on it. And one of the things he told me was, number one, he said, you got to tell the guys what to do. And I said, well, I'm a therapist. I can't tell people what to do. And he said, it's a self-help book. You got to tell people what to do. So the breaking free exercises that are in there, I think there's like 26 of them or so, came out of that. But another thing he said is, you know, all right, you've told guys basically, you know, what not to be or what's wrong with being a nice guy. So what's the alternative? I go, okay, that's good. That's good. So I thought, all right, so what is it? What are we going to call these guys? And I picked a term, you know, I said integrated male, but this, you know, we could call this almost anything, authentic man, conscious man,
right.
woke man, aware man, embodied man. Nowadays there's so many different ways, you know, as many different coaches as there are, there's different names we can call this. And that's fine. I made that term up. So whatever term we use is fine. But to just put it succinctly in my mind, and I write this in the book, and when I wrote an updated preface to it about 3 years ago, about kind of a 15th anniversary edition, I restated that recovery from the nice guy syndrome is not about becoming a different person or a better person. Mm-hmm. It's about becoming more us. It's about learning to love me, embrace me, welcome every part of me, and integrate. There's that integrated myth. Integrate every part of me. How I think, how I feel, how I experience the world. My humor, my intellect, my sexuality, my dark side, my passion, my aggression, welcome all of those pieces of ourself and integrate them into a conscious whole. You know, there's that consciousness there of being aware of every aspect of who I am, not having to hide any of that, dismiss any of it, paint over any of that, pretend it isn't there. And so for me, becoming that integrated male, that conscious male, that authentic male, that embodied male, you know, that open-hearted male, that cosmic male, that divine male, whatever it is, means embracing and loving and being me.
Right.
Right. We don't have to get better. One of my favorite writers is Pema Chodron. She's a Buddhist monk. And she basically talks about this process. And a lot of people write this way, is not about becoming something different, is shedding, you know, the armor that we put on, shedding the weaponry that we've added to protect ourselves, shedding those things we thought we had to become to be loved and liked and get our needs met. So recovery is not about being different, becoming different. It's letting go of a lot of these things that no longer serve us. They never did, but we added these things when we were 3 weeks old, 3 months old, 3 years old. They made sense to our very immature, undeveloped brain. But as adults now, to get what we want in love, sex, and life, to get our needs met, to be liked, to be loved, We actually have to start shedding our defense mechanisms, shedding the walls that we put up, shedding the persona that we create to be liked and loved, embracing those things we've been hiding and bringing them out into the open and the bright light of the day. And that is where we start. That's where recovery is. It's becoming more us. So how do we get there? So, hey, I wrote a book about that. So here's a couple basic premises that worked for me when I began my recovery. I do talk about them in the book, and I've been working with nice guys for over 25 years, so they work. Number one thing I say to all men, don't try to do this alone. We guys, we're lone wolves. I can get it done. No, we can't do that. If we could have done this ourselves, we wouldn't be listening to this podcast right now. We wouldn't have to read any self-help books. Mm. So go find safe people to do your work with. Get a coach. Get a men's group if you can. I'm 64 years old. I've been doing men's work for close to 30 years. I still have a coach. I'm in a men's program. Mm. I still am going and working on me. And again, not to become better, not to be good, but to just shed everything I've been packing around with me. So don't try to do this alone. Find a safe place to release your shame, to be real. Find a safe place to learn how to ground yourself, how to embrace your masculinity, connect with men, how to soothe yourself, how to deal with your anxiety states, how to be you, how to assert yourself, how to set boundaries, how to ask for what you want, how to surround yourself with people who want to help you get your needs met. Go find people that can help you learn that. And again, I love men's groups. I did most of my recovery in men's group. I'm still in a men's program. I led men's groups for years. Mm. When I left private practice in the Seattle area, I was leading 5 men's groups a week. They're powerful. This tribe, we men need that tribe. So go find people to help you do this. I've already mentioned, find the people, start working on your shame. Start revealing everything about you that you don't want anybody to know. In the men's program I'm in now, we still do exercises periodically. We just tell everybody, what I don't want you to know about me is. And it's amazing how many things actually come up when you start doing that, like free association style, that you didn't even know you were kind of keeping under wraps. From people thinking, I'm honest, I'm transparent. And I go, well, really, I don't want people to know about this. And I really don't want my brothers to know about this. And I don't want these guys to know about this. Tell it anyway. So releasing that shame is powerful. I mentioned already connecting with men. Most nice guys do not have a deep sense of connection to their own masculinity, and they're not particularly connected with other men. Often they're intimidated by men. They categorize men. Oh, they're just jerks. They just want to watch sports and drink beer and objectify women. I hear that from guys so much, and I go, bullshit. Mm. This world is filled with men who want to be conscious, who want to be authentic, who want real relationships with other guys. You're just using that as an excuse because it scares you to connect with men. Because again, most of us did not have a healthy, loving, trustworthy connection with men as little boys. So connect with men, embrace your masculinity. Another aspect of this is working at being honest and authentic. That's the thing I had to go to work on when I started. Because like I said, my second wife said, you got to go get help. I can't take your passive aggressive. Well, I was passive aggressive because I wasn't honest with her. I didn't tell her when I was pissed off at her. I didn't tell her what I really wanted. I was using covert contracts. So I had to learn to go start being honest, not only with her, but with clients and just with people in general. And that's still a high priority, is that I work at being honest, because it's so easy to leave out that part or shade it this way or just not bring that up. But then that starts building up the residue again. So work on being honest. Another big piece for nice guys is work on making your needs a priority. In the book, I talk about, put yourself first, make your needs a priority. Whenever I say that to nice guys, I get that deer in the headlight looks. Oh, fuck, that'll make me a selfish man. That'll make me an asshole jerk. Oh, no, nobody will like me or love me. Mm. The truth is, when you make your needs a priority, and that's to me the definition of a mature adult, you know, nobody's put on this planet to make sure you get your needs met. Mm-hmm. It was your parents' job, but that's done. Well, however poorly they did that job or however well they did it, it's your job now. It's your job to surround yourself with people, with professionals, with organizations, with practices, with hobbies, with whatever helps fill your bucket up, that is your job. But again, most nice guys think, oh no, if I do that, I'll be called selfish and people won't like it. The truth is, when our bucket is full and overflowing, it makes us amazingly attractive, right? And it just draws all things feminine to us. It draws adventure, opportunity, money, women, sex, dogs, cats, babies. It attracts everything. Mm-hmm. But when we're empty, right, and we're needy, and we're using covert contracts, the feminine wants nothing to do with us. That's repulsive to the feminine. Oh no, don't make me come fill you up. And so the more we make our needs a priority, and this is so core, and nice guys resist it so much because it is so contrary to our early conditioning. But we have to work at making our needs a priority, surround ourselves with, I call them, cooperative reciprocal relationships. It's the people and the professionals and the organizations that help us fill our bucket, and then we can give from the overflow and we attract from the overflow. So I've kind of hit you with just a bunch of the stuff that people, hopefully they're going, okay. So let me re-listen to that. So there is a real core recovery plan right there.
Oh man, so much there. Amazing. So yeah, I love what you said. It's not a matter of becoming something, of creating something. It's becoming more of just who we are at our core, at our masculine core.
Yeah.
And on that note, I think it makes so much sense that, you know, in society where we're growing up with all this feminine influence, you know, feminine or female teachers at school, where we're taught the concepts of a bad man, or as back in the day, all men are rapists, kind of a paradigm. And the cure that you suggest, or one of the, I guess, cures, quote unquote, of joining men's groups, having strong male friends, male role models and figures in your life, and connecting and opening up and just letting it spill all out, all the shame, everything. It just makes so much sense, even on a logical level, that is the cure to what we're not getting when we're younger. And on that note, I think we need more of that earlier on. I don't know what that looks like, but you know, as kids growing up, we need more male figures to let boys be boys. And you know, I know in native tribes and whatnot, there's always initiation processes. Yeah. I don't know. What are your thoughts on those? Do you think?
Well, yeah, I actually, that is the way now I actually these days talk a lot about this process is around in terms of tribe and initiation. Let me share a thought. And then let me kind of lay this out of what this can look like. Okay. I know, I'm on my third family as a dad. So right. I've got a 35-year-old son and a stepson from my second marriage who is the same age as my son. So I raised two boys there. I now have another 15-year-old stepson, and I came into his life when he was 8 or 9. And I love raising boys. And one of the things that I liked, especially raising my son and my stepson that are now in their 30s, is that they showed me a lot of what it meant to be male, to be unbridled masculine, because I encouraged them to be male. Now, I saw my job. See, for me growing up, and for a lot of men growing up, we had women with a female sensibility trying to raise us to be socialized males. And so, for example, like my sons, one of the things that kind of surprised me when they hit adolescence is they started spitting a lot, just everywhere they go, spitting. And you know, at first I was kind of repulsed by that, because I think I was probably taught at a pretty young age, don't spit, you know, that's not nice. So kind of more the female cleanliness mentality. Well, yeah, I did a little research on it and come to realize is that actually the spitting is just kind of natural male behavior. It's kind of a marking thing. There's testosterone in spit, apparently. Right. And so, you know, just the spitting is probably what adolescents do to mark territory, you know, just without even being conscious. It's wired into us.
Right.
Okay. So kind of the example I would give is that, you know, the feminine response to that, stop spitting, that's so gross. And so now the boy asks, okay, how do I not piss off the woman? I guess I better do, you know, quit. I better not do whatever it is that pisses her off. Right. And so they either hide it or maybe even do more of it in a passive aggressive, oppositionally defiant way. So, but from a masculine way, I saw my job is not to get them to quit spitting, but teach them to spit in a socially responsible way.
Right.
Right. You know, don't spit on the sidewalk. Don't spit, you know, if you're going to spit that direction, do it this way, you know, do it in ways that let you fit into society. That's what initiation is to some degree. It's not about necessarily spitting, but it's about the elders, the tribal leaders, teaching the young boys how to be male in a culture that they're going to be put into painful situations, scary situations, challenging situations, uncomfortable situations, and how to learn that they can handle those things, handle them with their tribe. They don't have to do it alone, but also to teach them the social skills of how to be part of a tribe, right? We're not just, you know, uncouth animals that just do whatever we do, when and where we want to do it. Even tribe is meant to initiate the little boys into having the social skills to fit in, but not to fit in the ways that maybe the women would want them to fit in, but in the ways that they can provide a contrast, a yin and a yang to the female energy of the tribe. And that yin and yang concept's been around for, you know, thousands and thousands of years. It's not new, that whole masculine, feminine
polarity
energy part.
Yep.
So the whole polarity of that. So to bring that to where we're at today, yes, I think that in general, little boys do not get any kind of healthy masculine initiation that teaches them how to be grounded, fierce, open-hearted, respectful, caring men. Right? We don't get that. So the story, the backstory, when I went on the book tour for No More Mr. Nice Guy, so this is 2003, 17 years ago. Did a lot of, you know, interviews with on the radio and television and stuff like that. And a common question I was asked a lot at that time is, did I see some kind of universal worldwide men's movement in similar to the feminism of the 60s and the 70s? And at that time I said, no, I really don't, because I don't see one unifying factor that would bring men together.
Right.
And especially one unifying factor that would bring men together that women would also rally behind to support, as men rallied behind to support a lot of aspects of feminism. Okay. So I was right and I was wrong, because I was right that I don't think there's been this one cause that has brought men together, but I was wrong. Now 17 years later, I am seeing a worldwide men's movement. Awesome. But how I would define it now is, it is men, whether they know it or not, looking for tribe, looking for masculine initiation and connection. Now, here's the beauty of it. Men are coming into this in all kinds of different ways. They may come into it by going to, you know, a men's divorce support group. They may get into it through a 12-step program.
Right.
They may get into it through going to a pickup boot camp. They may get into it by coming into Mankind Project New Warrior Weekend. They may get into it because they want to stop looking at porn, so they go to NoFap. They may get into it because they want to get strong in their body, so they go join a martial arts class. What I'm finding is that men are coming together with other men, not knowing they're looking for connection. They're thinking they want to learn martial arts.
Right.
They're thinking they want to learn how to pick up women. They're thinking they want to learn how to stop drinking. They think they want to learn how to get through a divorce. What they're really doing is getting into tribe. And the beauty of it is, now with the internet, and there's you know, a lot of good books out there, a lot of great coaches out there, a lot of interview podcasts, a lot of blogs, a lot of resources for men to go find tribe. When I started looking for tribe 25, 30 years ago, pretty much all there was kind of like Robert Bly's Iron John, Michael Mead, the whole mythopoetic movement, which is great. Great foundation for today's men's movement. But, you know, so that's about all there was, is you go out in the woods, beat a drum, talking stick, and say, ho. Now, that's good. I did that.
Right.
But it's gotten more practical and to down to earth and where we live as men. And so I'm excited. I get excited about like talking to people like
awesome.
You because I get to see the world that's out there, of how many men's coaches are out there, of how many men are helping men through podcasts and interviews and blogs and coaching and groups and programs and retreats. And it thrills me that now we've got men getting initiation into consciousness, in embodied, open-hearted, you know, divine, again, all, whatever you want to call it. And they will have an influence on the younger generation of boys coming up. Because that's one thing I see in the men's program I'm in, is how many of the men are really focused on being conscious fathers. And you know, and I love seeing that. And I look at my son, he's 35. He has my granddaughter's going to be 14 next month. And he is the most amazing dad. And she's just the most amazing young woman. And I see that trend happening of dads really showing up and you know, and parenting in really powerful ways, sons and daughters. So I'm excited. I'm excited about, you know, what's going on in the world. Yeah, there's all that negative noise, you know, toxic masculinity, hashtag Me Too. And, you know, we need to hear it. We need to hear that men have treated women badly, that women have been violated and abused. We need to hear that. But that doesn't mean we need to go the opposite direction and become passive and avoidant and unavailable. We need to claim our fierceness. We need to own our dark side. We need to embrace our sexuality. We need to step up and be leaders. And you know, that noise needs to get our attention, but it doesn't need to get us stuck or derailed.
Right. Oh, I love that. It's, yeah, I totally agree with you in saying that it's important to acknowledge what, you know, the women's movement, the feminine movement, and the history behind that without, as you say, jumping to the absolute extreme and having the opposite effect on men and creating even more issues moving forward. So that's great. And it's great to hear that you having a, not to age you at all, but having a view at this since day one, quote unquote, you're optimistic, and that's so good to hear. Obviously from someone who's been in the men's space for a long time, doing great work. Okay, almost out of time here, Robert, but one thing I wanted to touch on very quickly before we adjourn was, and you mentioned it briefly, is it a part of the cure to moving towards being an integrated male and becoming us was boundary setting, as well as you know, yeah, I guess boundary setting is what I'm saying there. So, and I know I've noticed that hugely since I read your book. That was something that was a big wow, slap in the face. Like, oh man, I got to start saying no at certain, you know, at certain times when it doesn't serve me, when I'm putting others' needs ahead of my own. And that doesn't mean, and it's exactly what you said. It was, you know, in my mind, it was like, I'm being selfish if I say no to this. But if it's at the expense of my own core and masculine core, it's probably not worth it. If you just want to talk a little bit of the power of boundary setting.
Sure. I'd love to. Yeah. In case I did not mention that as one of the core pieces to work on in Nice Guy Recovery, it is a core piece. I remember when I did, you know, mention, you know, I started going to a 12-step groups and got a therapist. And the very first session I had with a therapist is a woman therapist. And I remember meeting in her office, and in our very first session, she showed me about boundaries. Now, looking back, I don't know if she did that like with every client in their first session, or if she could just see I needed that information. Mm-hmm. Now, I was in my early 30s, in my second marriage, and already had a PhD in marriage and family therapy, and right. I'd never heard of boundaries. I had no concept of what personal boundaries were. So what she did was put a string on the ground and said, you stand over on that side. I'm going to stand on this side. That's your space. This I'm over here. That line is your boundary. And she said, I'm going to walk across that line, put my hands on your shoulders and start to push you backwards. When you begin to feel uncomfortable, stop me. I said, okay. And so, you know, I started about 2 feet behind my line, which of course, if I don't know what boundaries are or where to set them, you know, I'm not going to step right up to my line. That might seem aggressive, right? No, but so I'm behind my line. You know, most of us don't know where our lines are. And if we do have one, we never actually get up to it. So I'm already behind my line. She walks in. So she's already in my space, you know, from the get-go. Puts her hands on my shoulders, starts pushing me backwards. I take a step or two backwards and I say, stop. And she keeps pushing and, you know, and I keep backpedaling and I go, stop. And she keeps pushing. And finally, I'm about to the wall, right? My back's about to the wall. I finally kind of got into more of a lineman stance, planted a foot, got my hands up on her shoulders, and stopped her. You know, that felt like I was being like aggressive, like, wow. Oh, no. Yeah. But you know, I physically stopped her. And she smiled and said, good. I thought, all right, what is this? You know, I really did not know what this was about. So then she used that example to talk with me about boundaries and about how boundaries are essential. And I've been building on this since then. They're essential for human existence. I mean, to be alive, we have to have boundaries. Our skin is a boundary. It keeps our innards out and what's out, you know, from getting in. Mm-hmm. Boundaries are essential. To get close to other people, we have to have boundaries. We've got to be able to say, yes, no, stop, I don't want to, I'm leaving now, you know, whatever. And because boundaries let people get close to us. If we don't have boundaries, we'll have to either build walls that protect us or completely avoid people altogether.
Right.
So the ability to set boundaries are a positive thing, even though most nice guys think, oh, no, if I set boundaries, that's going to piss people off. Now, typically, most boundaries are just, I say the best boundaries are the ones that invite other people into higher consciousness, okay? They're not about getting people to stop doing stuff in general. In fact, I tell everybody I work with around boundaries. Boundaries are not about getting other people to be different. They're about getting you to be different. They're about getting you up to your line. They're about you getting up and saying stop. They're about you actually stopping, you know, the person.
Right.
You removing yourself if you need to. And I've often said the ultimate power to set a boundary is the willingness and ability to remove yourself, which is why the majority of adults on this planet know nothing about boundaries, because most of our life we were little, you know, at least the first 14, 15 years of our life, we were smaller than everybody else. Mm. Everybody else could do whatever they wanted to us. Parents could do whatever they wanted. Older siblings could do whatever they wanted. Teachers, priests, whoever, neighbor bullies could do whatever they wanted. And we didn't know we could stop them. That's just how the world works, right? Big people do whatever they want to little people.
Right.
Now we grow up to be bigger people, but we still have the little person mentality that people can do whatever they want. And you can't, you know, you have to let them. And so we do build walls, or we do just start avoiding people because we don't know about boundaries. And as children, we could not remove ourselves. That's usually not an option. Mm. Now, as adults, we can. Now, removing ourselves might mean just a little bit, saying, I'm getting off the phone now. Call me back when you're in a better mood. It might mean, I'm taking for a walk. I'm going for a walk. We'll revisit this conversation later. It might mean, if you ever do that again, you'll never see me again.
Right.
Okay. You know, whatever is needed, whatever degree is needed, is a healthy race consciousness boundary. Now, here's the deal. Most people don't know when they've stepped over our line. They don't know. You know, maybe they inadvertently step on your toe. And, you know, they didn't know that. They didn't do it on purpose. And you say, hey, man, you stepped on my toe. Most people say, hey, I'm sorry about that, man. Didn't even know that. Mm. That's a boundary that lets somebody know they stepped on your toe. And you're going to say, oh, thanks for letting me know. I didn't know it. You've raised their consciousness. Right? They now know that. Mm. Now, you may run into other people that as you set boundaries with them, you know, they may just stomp on your toe more. You know, there may be other people that say, don't be such a baby, you know, man up, quit crying, blah, blah, blah. Those people I don't hang out with, by the way. I just don't hang out with people that think, I call them professional boundary invaders. Mm. But for example, the raising of people's consciousness, it's a nice little hack, a nice little shortcut or trick for boundary setting. Now, you first of all have to pay attention to what you're feeling. You got to know something felt bad to you, right? Like you got to know, I'm tempted to say yes when I really don't want to. You got to actually know that, right?
Right, right.
Okay, so let's say in some context, you know, you feel hurt, you feel dismissed, or you feel like somebody was mean or, you know, was dismissive or demeaning. Just a cool little hack, again, if you can just notice, is to say, ouch. Begin with the ouch. Mm. That's so disarming, right? Usually we go, you know, you stepped on my toe, god damn it, or, you know, you were mean to me, or you're being reactive, accusing. Then they go on the defensive and nobody comes into higher consciousness. But if you say ouch, that's kind of a disarming way to get their attention and say, that hurt. Did you mean it to? Mm-hmm. So you've told them how it felt and you've asked them, did you mean to hurt me? Mm. Now, It's an invitation to them to be conscious, to ponder. Now, they may say, no, I didn't mean to. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that came across wrong. I didn't mean to hurt you. They're now conscious that their behavior did have an effect on you that hurt you, right? That's higher consciousness.
Right.
Or they may, if they are willing to be invited into higher consciousness, may say, you know, I have been pissed off at you. I think that was a poke. I think I did mean to hurt you. And then you can say, I'd rather you just tell me what you're pissed off about then. You know, let's have a conversation. You know, adult humans can do that. And so maybe now they tell you what they've been pissed off about, but not telling you because for whatever reason, but they took pokes at you instead, right? And so that invited them into higher consciousness. Or you may say, ouch, that hurt. Did you mean it to? And you may get that, no, you're just a big baby. Quit whining. And then you go, okay. All right. You don't have to convince them what they did was hurtful. You don't have to convince them they shouldn't do it. But as an adult, you get to make a decision of how much time you want to spend around that person, how far they get to come into your space, right, what they get to do while they're in there, and how long till they have to leave. And you may decide to limit your contact with those kinds of people, which I do, as I said.
Right. So
I don't hang out with perfect people, but I hang out with people who are willing to be invited into higher consciousness.
Nice.
So boundaries allow us, I'll wrap this up with just an example most people can relate to. Most of us occasionally sometimes drive in a car. So you get in your car and drive anywhere, there's going to be boundaries everywhere you go. There's going to be white lines on the road. There's going to be yellow lines. There's going to be dotted lines, solid lines, double solid lines, road signs, yields, stop, speed limits, crosswalks, stoplights. Those are all boundaries, and they all allow a lot of cars to coexist in close proximity at high rates of speed without all crashing into each other and existing in constant gridlock. That's the power and beauty and the utility of boundaries.
Okay. So just translating that to a human context is it allows us to exist in the world with thousands, millions of other people without crashing into each other or sabotaging our car.
Exactly. It lets us coexist, and hopefully all of us arrive at the destination we want to get to without smashing everybody else's, you know, life, car, whatever along the way. Yeah. So boundaries are good. They're good. And I say that because, again, a lot of nice guys I work with think, oh, no, people are going to be pissed at me if I set boundaries.
Right, right.
Well, boundaries allow people to get close. They allow you to love people and be in close proximity with them.
Right. Okay. Awesome. Okay. Awesome. Thank you for delving into boundary setting. Okay. Before we let you go very quickly here, Dr. Robert Glover, this is a question I ask all guests on the show. You can answer in as little or as many words as you'd like. But the question being, if you could give a message to the version of yourself who is at the lowest point, aka rock bottom of your life, what would that message be?
That's a good version of that question. That is.
It's a toughie. Hey, take your time.
You'll handle it. Whatever happens, you'll handle it.
Love it. And I know you talk about that exact quote in your book. So if you want to hear the significance of what he means by that quote, buy the book. No more Mr. Nice Guy. Little shameless plug there.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, first of all, from one recovering nice guy to another, thank you for doing this.
You're welcome. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, where can our listeners go to connect with you? Do you have any upcoming programs or anything?
I've always got stuff going on. Awesome. drglover.com, just drglover.com, has all my online classes. I have an online university with self-help courses. I do workshops both in person. I still actually am going to try to do some. And I've now got virtual workshops, so they come do workshops with me. I've got over 200 podcasts that I've recorded, a lot around dating, a lot around relationship, work and career. I do a limited amount of one-on-one consultation. So just check out drglover.com. They can also check out datingessentialsformen.com. which has all the dating materials. Just as a aside, I had to learn to date in my late 40s, and I learned how to do it and got good. And so, guy starts to teach us what you're doing. So I call it the unpickup approach to dating, of how to really date in more authentic, conscious kinds of ways. So they can go to datingessentials.com. If they just want to Google "no more Mr. Nice Guy," Google Robert Glover. I come up about the top 10 spots on both of those searches. So pretty easy to find.
Awesome. He's everywhere. Man, thank you so much once again. This is an absolute pleasure. As mentioned, anyone listening, buy the book, "No More Mr. Nice Guy." Changed my life, can change yours too. And yeah, just thanks again.
Mitch, thank you. It's been fun.